KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. A federal judge is demanding the Trump administration explain why sending planes of migrants to El Salvador was not a violation of his order to turn the planes around. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Senator Chuck Schumer is facing criticism for voting with Republicans to fund the government. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadel. We talked to two Democratic strategists about whether the party can agree on how to fight President Trump's agenda. Also, Forever 21's heyday is likely over forever, and how iguanas from America might have found their way to the South Pacific millions of years ago. It's Tuesday, March 18th, 100 years ago today. A tornado killed almost 700 people in Missouri, Illinois, and Indiana. It was the deadliest tornado in U.S. history. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. A federal judge has upbraided the Justice Department. That's for defying multiple court rulings ordering that U.S. deportation flights be turned around last Saturday. The flights were carrying hundreds of migrants whom the Trump administration says are Venezuelan criminals. NPR's Sergio Martinez Beltran has more.
The Trump administration has to explain why it did not comply with the judge's oral and written orders to stop using the Alien Enemies Act to remove migrants to El Salvador. The White House says they include suspected members of Tren de Aragua, which the U.S. recently designated a foreign terror group. The Justice Department argued that an oral ruling was not enough to stop them, but that they did not fly any more migrants once the written order was released. Judge James Boasberg called that, quote, a heck of a stretch. Sergio Martinez Beltran, NPR News.
Israel says it's continuing its airstrikes in Gaza. Health authorities in Gaza say at least 400 Palestinians have been killed and hundreds more have been wounded overnight. Some victims are young children. The Israeli government says it's attacking to pressure Hamas to release more Israeli hostages. But Hamas says it won't do so under a new ceasefire agreement that Israel, along with the U.S., have been pushing. NPR's Hadil Al-Shelchi has more.
Israel says it is conducting, quote, extensive strikes in Gaza. This is the first major round of Israeli strikes in Gaza since the initial phase of a ceasefire deal ended at the beginning of the month. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he ordered the strikes because Hamas has repeatedly refused to release all the hostages. The shaky first phase of the ceasefire deal saw 33 hostages held by Hamas released and about 2,000 Palestinian prisoners freed from Israeli jails. The White House spokesperson said that it was, quote, consulted before the attacks. Hadil Al-Shalchi, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Stocks opened lower this morning as the Commerce Department reported a rebound in home building activity last month. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average slipped about 230 points in early trading.
Home building activity picked up last month after a cold and snowy January. Builders broke ground on more than 11% more homes than the month before. Building permits, however, were down in February, which suggests a possible slowdown in the months to come. A survey by the National Association of Home Builders finds builders are nervous about the rising cost of construction materials, which could be exacerbated by President Trump's tariffs. Industrial production revved up last month, led by a solid jump in auto manufacturing. Output of factories that make products other than vehicles rose by 0.4%. Utility production was down in February as warmer weather reduced demand for heat. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow is now down nearly 250 points. The Nasdaq is down more than 300, or down almost 2%. It's NPR. The Defense Department says it has ordered a U.S. Navy destroyer to the southern U.S. border. The agency says this is part of President Trump's move to seal the border and crack down on immigration. The USS Gravely will sail in the Gulf of Mexico, which President Trump says he has renamed the Gulf of America. The destroyer will also participate in stopping drug trafficking. China's biggest electric vehicle maker saw its stock price jump today. That came a day after it announced the development of a new EV battery. NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports from Beijing. It charges about as fast as it takes to pump gas into a conventional car.
The new battery and charger are made by BYD, based in southern China's Shenzhen City. BYD claims their new battery and charger can power a car for almost 250 miles on a 5-minute charge. That's twice as fast as it takes to charge a Tesla. Some Tesla EVs use batteries made by BYD. Sales of EVs and hybrid vehicles in China jumped by 40% last year, with Chinese carmakers increasingly outselling their foreign rivals. BYD sells EVs in Europe and South America. In the U.S., it sells buses, but has no plans to sell passenger cars, due in part to tariffs and regulatory hurdles. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Beijing.
President Trump has nominated an airline executive as his nominee to run the Federal Aviation Administration. He's tapping the CEO of Republic Airways, Brian Bedford. Leaders of other airlines are praising Bedford's nomination. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadil in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Culver City, California. Coming up, we hear from two Democratic strategists about whether their party can unite in their opposition to President Trump's agenda. But first,
a federal judge wants the Justice Department to explain its actions in deportations that took place over the weekend.
Yeah, the judge asks for a sworn declaration from the DOJ by noon today detailing how planes carrying alleged Venezuelan gang members were flown from the U.S. to El Salvador despite a judge's orders to turn the planes around. A hearing yesterday saw a heated debate unfold about when exactly the orders were issued and whether they had to be in writing to restrain government action. The incident is bringing the administration closer to a constitutional face-off.
NPR's Franco Ordonez is here with more about how President Trump is testing his executive powers. Good morning, Franco.
Good morning, Lila.
So this story really blew up over the weekend. What's the controversy here?
Well, I mean, the controversy is whether the U.S. government defied a legal court order, which would be a potential breakdown between the executive branch and the judicial branch. And many legal experts say this would create a major constitutional crisis. Now, the White House says they did not ignore the court, and they're painting this as a counterterrorism operation. They say most of the migrants on the plane were members of a Venezuelan gang known as Tren de Agua. Others were from the Salvadoran gang, MS-13. But really, as you noted, part of this debate is over the timing of the order. The White House says the written order was issued after the flights had taken off, but earlier the judge did give a verbal order.
Okay, so before we talk about the legal issues, how does the White House view the politics of this issue?
I mean, politically, they see this as a winning issue. I mean, it's one Trump campaigned on, and they're claiming this operation is him carrying out that promise. I mean, they feel that most Americans care more that violent gang members are being removed from the country. I mean, they even made light of the controversy yesterday and over the weekend, reposting a note by the Salvadoran president who wrote online, quote, oopsie, too late, after the judge called back the plane. And they're also posting on social media video of tattooed migrants with their hands chained boarding planes to different kinds of music.
So making light of this really important question of whether or not the Trump administration defied the court order, what did the Trump administration say about that?
Well, they say they did not. And I did speak with Justin Levitt, a law professor at Loyola Marymount University, who served in the Biden White House. He said it's clear the Trump administration is attacking the judicial branch in alarming ways, but he said it was not clear whether the administration was actually violating those orders yet.
So what I see them doing so far is playing footsie with the notion of defying a court order rather than actually defying a court order. They're getting cute. They're getting up to the line.
You know, he adds that they talk tough on TV and press briefings. Vice President Vance has attacked judges, saying they're not allowed to control executive branch. Just yesterday, the border czar, Tom Homan, said on Fox he didn't care what judges think. But so far, Levitt says the Trump administration has complied with the orders, albeit reluctantly.
And how does this test of Trump's power fit with other moves the administration's making?
I mean, this is a case that should not be looked at in a vacuum. The question at hand is not whether or not these people are dangerous and should be in the country, but the process of their removal. Is it legal? And specifically, did the administration knowingly ignore this order? This is just another example, though, of how the White House is working to stretch its powers. And we have seen this with the legislative branch, and we're now seeing it in the judicial branch.
Thanks, Franco.
Thank you.
That's White House correspondent Franco Ordonez. Now we turn to the opposition party. From immigration to trade to mass federal layoffs, the Trump administration is attempting to reshape the United States at home and abroad with brute force. Democrats are under pressure from their supporters to fight the Trump agenda, but have few options as the minority party in both chambers of Congress. And they seem to be unable to wield the little leverage they do have, like playing obstacle to the president's agenda. That came into sharp focus when Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer voted in favor of a Republican bill last week to fund the government. The move triggered a backlash among the party's rank and file and voters. So how can the party stand up to Trump's agenda? Here to talk about that is Paul Begala, former chief strategist of Bill Clinton's 1992 presidential campaign, and Waleed Shaheed, who has played a key role in developing the more progressive wing of the party, working with lawmakers like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Waleed, I want to start with you. We've been watching this infighting inside the Democratic Party on how to wield its very, very limited power. In light of Senator Schumer's move last week, is the party sort of blowing up from within? And how can they unite?
I mean, what Chuck Schumer did was an embarrassing blunder. You had House Democrats marching in one direction and Senate Democrats marching in the same direction until the very last minute and leaving House Democrats holding the bag. But, you know, one thing is, if the American public are waiting for Chuck Schumer or party elites or the court to save us, we're already losing. We need the amount of social movement activity we need in this country. If there's truly a constitutional crisis, if there's a billionaire corporate coup by Elon Musk underway, we need action. In other countries, when democracy is on the line, the public doesn't just watch. They flood the streets, they shut down business as usual, they take nonviolent action, they engage in boycotts. That's not the scale of the action we're seeing, nothing close to what we saw in 2017 with Trump's first presidency, with in 2020 with protests around the murder of George Floyd. If we're serious about defending democracy, we need to flex the muscle of American civil society. And so while I'm incredibly angry with Chuck Schumer, we need leaders. We need people to get involved because history is made by those who fight. We can't just wait for Senate Democrats to do the right thing. We need to see the public engaged on these issues and not just the political leaders.
Paul, do you see it the same way?
Oh, slightly differently. I don't blame the public. The public is doing a great job. Okay. Senator Schumer, I think, should have compromised. He didn't. He caved. He had something very valuable. Democratic votes to pass the continuing resolution the Republicans wanted. And he traded it for nothing. right? I think he should have forced the Republicans to the table, and he should have brought a menu that helps the middle class. Where I slightly, maybe only slightly, disagree with Waleed is this is a tale of two parties. Okay, in Washington, they're defeated, they're divided, they're directionless. Mm-hmm. Out in America, they're kicking butt. Democrats are winning special elections all around the country. There's a Senate district, state Senate district in Iowa, in the eastern part of the state. Trump carried it by 21 points. Okay, a Democrat named Mike Zimmer just won it by 3.5 points. So you're swinging 25 points in a couple of months. We won special elections in Minnesota, in Virginia, in New York, in Oklahoma. And the big one, the really big one, your listeners all got to dial in on, April 1st, Wisconsin Supreme Court. Elon Musk, the richest man in the world, is putting millions of dollars into that. I think the Democrats are going to win in part because, well, the liberal will win. They don't do it by party, but the progressive will win because Mr. Musk is putting so much money in. So there is a reaction out there in America. Go try to go to a Republican Congress member's town hall. They'll scream at you. So there's a ton of energy and excitement and enthusiasm, and we're actually winning elections. That's the coin of the realm for me.
So I'm listening to you both, and I will say we've heard a lot of voters express extreme disappointment in Democrats, voters who support Democrats who have concerns about the Trump agenda over their failure to stand up to anything really. So for both of you, what is your sense of how voters, Democrats, feel about their party, and where should the party go from here? Waleed, if we start with you.
Well, I think the Democratic Party's job is not to defend institutions, it's to transform them. So institutions aren't sacred relics handed down from heavens, they're tools, and tools are only as useful as the work they're doing. And I think this past election, we saw so many Democratic leaders say, we can't just defend democracy or say we're defending democracy and say we're defending institutions. If you care about democracy, you don't protect institutions for their own sake, you protect the values they're supposed to uphold. And I think what we saw with Chuck Schumer this past week was kind of the knee-jerk way of going back to defending the norms, doing business as usual. I think Democrats need to get out there. The most important thing that we need to do is focus on how we slow down this corporate coup by Elon Musk, how we gum up the works, and how we communicate to the American people, because I still don't think it's fully trickled down to the American people. The scale and the speed at which Elon Musk has seized citizens' data, private companies' data, the way that he's gutting, one of the wealthiest men in the world is trying to gut your grandma's Social Security to pass a tax cut that benefits billionaires like him. These singular laser-focused messages on affordability, on the billionaire capture of our government, and also how they're trying to distract you with taking over, flooding social media with stories about how immigrants and the LGBT community or diversity is to blame for plane crashes in this country. I mean, it is the biggest scam in modern American history.
Paul?
One word, betrayal. Not resistance, betrayal. Democrats need to go to the country, particularly those people who voted for Donald Trump. You know, he won the middle class. He won voters who make less than $50,000 a year. If my party doesn't serve the middle class, the working class, we don't deserve to exist. So rather than allowing our party to be distracted by elite, esoteric, woke cultural issues, get right back to the meat and potatoes. And I think actually Waleed and I are closer than you might think. I mean, Democrats need to go. The big, big fight here is going to be when we have the Trump budget in September, which will cut Medicaid, cut Medicare, cut Social Security, cut public education, by the way, and cut people in Trump counties, in Trump communities, in Trump states far more, frankly, than blue America. So I think we just got to focus on folks whose names are stitched above the pocket of their shirt, not those whose pronouns are typed at the bottom of their emails.
Democratic strategist Paul Begala and Waleed Shaheed, thank you both for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
This is NPR News. Thank you.
A new TV comedy series called The Studio is about a freshly appointed movie studio head trying to keep the company afloat as Hollywood changes around him. The show includes Martin Scorsese, Zoe Kravitz, and Ice Cube playing versions of themselves. On the next Fresh Air, we talk to the co-creator and star of The Studio, Seth Rogen. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Moderna, committed to protecting people from COVID-19, the CDC recommends getting a second dose of this season's COVID-19 vaccine for those 65 and older. Doctors can advise about getting a second dose. From Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for dedicated and forward-thinking individuals to join their growing team. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm A. Martinez. President Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin will talk later today. A phone call that could move Russia closer to approving a ceasefire proposal in Ukraine that the U.S. has already supported. Join us to preview what we can expect is NPR's Russia correspondent, Charles Maine. So, Charles, the White House has signaled it is cautiously optimistic, but based on what?
Well, a White House envoy, Steve Witkoff, was in Moscow last week where he met with Putin behind closed doors. Afterward, Witkoff came away saying the U.S. had bridged the gap in differences between Russia and Ukraine. Now, Putin, you know, he's publicly endorsed the U.S. plan in principle, but raised a host of issues over how to actually implement it. Everything from how to monitor the ceasefire to what might prevent Ukraine from using the pause to rearm and regroup. Despite that, Trump, speaking on Air Force One Sunday, suggested the groundwork had already been laid for a potential breakthrough.
A lot of it already discussed very much by both sides.
You'll ask him.
Ukraine and Russia.
Now, in those comments, Trump went on to say land and power plants were among assets on the table that could be divided up in a wider deal to end the war. So Trump's business approach to negotiations very much on display.
Okay. What does the plan actually do, though, Charles?
Well, you know, it's a first step, essentially. It would place a 30-day ban on all attacks by both Moscow and Kyiv. The idea here being that if it works, renew it and keep talking and eventually wind the war down itself. Now, Ukraine signed on to the ceasefire plan following marathon talks with the U.S. and Saudi Arabia last week. In doing so, Kyiv appeared to overcome charges from Trump that Ukraine wasn't interested in peace. In fact, as soon as Kyiv signed on to the ceasefire deal, Trump lifted a ban on U.S. military and intelligence support to Ukraine. And given all that, the question now is how will Putin respond?
One of the criticisms going in is that Trump has been demanding huge concessions from Ukraine, but not necessarily many from Russia. Has any of that changed?
Well, we'll have to see. You know, as Trump put it, he doesn't think Ukraine holds a lot of cards. The Kremlin, meanwhile, has been unwavering in its core demands that Ukraine give up territory annexed by Moscow and end its ambitions to join NATO. I put the question of what, if anything, the Kremlin was giving up to Sergei Markov. He's a former Putin spokesman. His answer, a promise not to seize more Ukrainian territory. That is the concession, says Markov.
It's already such huge compromise that even I'm interesting how Vladimir Putin will tell about this to the Russian public.
So Markov here is saying Putin would be giving up a lot in the eyes of Russians by simply not pressing its current military advantage. I'd only add that if there are any concessions from Putin, they appear to be aimed at Trump. You know, Putin is essentially offering Trump business opportunities, everything from rare earth minerals to investments if and when sanctions are lifted.
So more of a form of direct U.S.-Russia horse trading. So is President Trump similarly offering anything in return?
Well, you could argue, yes. Trump this week ended U.S. involvement in a Biden-era probe that sought to hold Putin legally responsible for the invasion of Ukraine. But Trump also, on his own, decided to gut the Voice of America and its sister organization, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Both U.S. government media outlets were a source of news coverage that could be critical not only of Putin's Russia, but of much of the autocratic former post-Soviet space, for example, in Central Asia and Belarus. You know, another way to think about that, you know, we knew Putin saw Russia's fear of influence extending to much of the former Soviet Union politically. Well, with this decision, Trump has ceded it to Putin, that sphere of influence informationally as well. And propagandists in Moscow couldn't be happier.
All right, that's NPR's Russia correspondent, Charles Maines. Charles, thanks.
Thank you.
Here's a reptilian mystery millions of years in the making. How did land-loving iguanas, normally found in the Americas, wind up thousands of miles away in the South Pacific in Fiji? NPR's Jonathan Lambert has more on some possible answers.
Scientists have two major theories to explain how iguanas ended up on the tropical island Fiji. Simon Scarpetta is a biologist at the University of San Francisco.
People had suggested that they must have taken some kind of raft of downed vegetation from somewhere in the Americas all the way across the Pacific, you know, through the doldrums of the equator, through the southern equatorial current, and then made their way to Fiji.
The other idea is that Fijian iguanas got there much more gradually. Over many generations, iguanas from the Americas might have walked or island hopped over land bridges that are now underwater. But biologists haven't had enough evidence to distinguish between these possibilities.
We didn't really know how the Fijian iguanas were related to other iguanas, and then we also didn't really know how old they were.
To figure that out, Scarpetta and his colleagues used genomic data to build a detailed family tree. The results, published in the journal PNAS, surprised him.
The iguanas that live on Fiji were most closely related to a group of iguanas that I knew very well from the United States, called desert iguanas.
Scarpetta estimates that these iguanas split a little over 30 million years ago, a timeline that doesn't quite line up with the land bridge idea. Instead, he thinks a small group of iguanas made one single trip from North America to Fiji. Similar, albeit shorter, trips have been observed on tangles of downed trees in the Caribbean.
People saw in real time that green iguanas were able to get around 300 kilometers just floating on displaced vegetation from one island to the other, and so that was super cool.
Reaching Fiji would have been nearly 30 times as far, but if any creature could survive, it's iguanas.
They're herbivorous, and so if they're floating around on vegetation, they may even have a source of food to eat.
And with desert origins, these iguanas could have survived dehydration and the intense equatorial sun as they slowly drifted towards their new home. Jonathan Lambert, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Demand for cheaper alternatives to obesity drugs like Wegovy and Zepbound has exploded in recent years.
They're making millions off of this and helping so many people. There's no way this is going to stop being available.
But an upcoming deadline for factories to stop making alternative versions may cut off those who can't afford the name brands. I'm Elsa Chang. That story on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Hamas says five of its senior leaders were among many people killed by Israeli airstrikes in Gaza overnight. NPR's Hadil Al-Shalchi is in Tel Aviv.
Explosions could be heard across the strip. The Gaza Health Ministry says hundreds of Palestinians have been killed, including children. Also, an Israeli military spokesman warned residents in several Gaza neighborhoods to start evacuating immediately.
The ministry says the number of injured tops 550. Israel says it was targeting Hamas officials amid stalled talks with mediators about extending the ceasefire in Gaza. The Trump administration is defending the deportation of a Lebanese doctor who was living and working in the U.S. legally. Dr. Rasha Alawi specializes in kidney transplant issues and was working for a health nonprofit affiliated with Brown University. Olivia Eberts with the public radio in Rhode Island reports on what the administration is saying.
They said that she had attended the funeral of the assassinated Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah in February. That's while she was home visiting her country of Lebanon. And since then, we haven't been able to get in touch with her to get her response.
Nasrallah was killed by an Israeli airstrike in Beirut back in September. This is NPR News from Washington. The White House says President Trump will be speaking with Russian President Vladimir Putin this morning. They're expected to discuss the U.S. proposal for a 30-day ceasefire in Ukraine. That plan was agreed to by Kyiv during last week's meeting with the U.S. delegation in Saudi Arabia. Putin has said he wants certain conditions attached. Rwandan-backed M23 rebels have pulled out of peace talks with the Democratic Republic of Congo. They were supposed to take place today, as Kate Bartlett reports.
M23 rebels withdrew from the peace talks one day after the European Union imposed sanctions on Rwandan army commanders and the group's leader. The M23 spokesman, Lawrence Kanyuka, wrote on X that international institutions were deliberately working to sabotage peace, making talks impossible. Rwanda has given Belgian diplomats 48 hours to leave the country after cutting diplomatic ties. Kigali said Belgium had taken sides against the country in the conflict. Since the beginning of the year, the M23, which the Rwandan government has denied backing, has taken control of two key cities in mineral-rich eastern DRC. For NPR News, I'm Kate Bartlett in Johannesburg.
The Los Angeles Dodgers beat the Chicago Cubs today 4-1 to kick off Major League Baseball's regular season. That game was played at the Tokyo Dome in Japan. Stocks on Wall Street are lower this morning. The Dow is down 184 points. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C. Good morning. The U.S. Institute of Peace was the scene of a hostile takeover by the Department of Government Efficiency.
They were helped by D.C. police.
D.C. police showed up at my office and said, it's time for you to go.
That's George Moose, who had been running the Institute, which is a think tank funded by Congress.
NPR's Michelle Kellerman spoke to him on the steps of the Institute just across from the State Department, and she joins us now. Good morning, Michelle.
Good morning, Leila.
So, Michelle, you were right there once DOGE forced their way into the building. What did you see?
Yeah, I mean, they tried several times to get in to install a new president, and they finally made it in at the end of the day. The White House says Moose was fired last week along with most of the board members. Moose is challenging that, and he was holed up in his office for a while yesterday after he says Doge broke in. But police caught up with him and escorted him out. He called it a sad day, and he talked about the work that he and his colleagues do there.
This building really was built not just as a platform for the work that we do. It was built as a symbol of the aspiration of the American people to be peace builders in the world. That's why it is as beautiful as it is. And I have to believe that in the long term, that purpose, that mission will be reaffirmed, and that we will, in one way or another, be allowed to continue it.
He says it's a mission that should be in line with the Trump administration. You know, they try to come up with ideas to resolve conflicts and promote peace. Moose, like many of the employees at USIP, is a retired diplomat. He seems really shocked by the way that the Trump administration has been dismantling parts of America's soft power, starting with the lead U.S. aid agency and now coming to the U.S. Institute of Peace.
Michelle, the question I have, and I think so many people have, is this legal? Can the Trump administration do this? Because this isn't a government agency, right? It's a nonprofit funded by Congress.
Yeah, I mean, Doge says that D.C. police escorted in his replacement after Moose refused to let in the replacement. A White House official called Moose a, quote, career bureaucrat who wants to be unaccountable to the American people. But a lawyer for USIP says that all of this is being done illegally, that President Trump, you know, he can fire board members, but only for cause. And the lawyer, George Foote, also explains that USIP is not a government agency. It has a bit of a different legal status, and it also owns the building. He spoke to me outside the building yesterday.
So the building has been seized by force by police officers with guns, acting under the authority of a resolution that we're going to have a court declare to be invalid.
So this seems to be a pattern with Doge, right? An attempt to cut funds without consulting Congress, only for it to all land in court.
Yeah, I mean, Foote told me that Doge is using their usual playbook here, but he's convinced that the law is on USIP's side. We'll have to see, though, what the courts decide and see if USIP employees can get back to their building and regain access to their computers. It'll also be interesting, Leila, to see if anyone in Congress steps in. After all, Congress created the U.S. Institute of Peace and funds it.
That's NPR's Michelle Kellerman. Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you.
Forever 21 has filed for bankruptcy again, and this time it could actually be forever as the company prepares to close all stores and wind down operations. Here's NPR's Alina Selyuk.
Peak Forever 21 was in the early 2000s when no self-respecting mall could go without the store. Vast and bright and chaotic, overrun by cute tank tops, tight skirts, and graphic tees.
I think it just had this really big kind of bodacious presence in the mall.
Tasha Lewis teaches fashion and retail studies at The Ohio State University. Forever 21 was often the draw, the reason young people came to the mall, a moment in time that had many millennials on TikTok reeling this week from the news of the store's demise.
I'm so sad. I don't really shop here that often, but you know, it's sad when stores you grew up with go out of business.
I'm sad, but I don't really shop there, says TikToker Zia Janae, and that is the basics of what went wrong with Forever 21. Greg Bortel, who advises retailers as a partner at the consulting firm Kearney, says the chain did not keep up with its shoppers.
So if we think about that first time when Forever 21 caught magic, it was among a particular consumer group. That consumer group changes and ages.
And you either choose to age with them or you fight for younger shoppers again and again and again.
You're only as good as your last season.
Forever 21 rose at the dawn of the fast fashion era, one of its original giants, who would take styles you'd see on runways or magazine pages and bring them to your local mall in a blink of an eye and cheaply. it expanded aggressively. By 2010s, Lua says she remembers trying to figure out the company's unique angle.
I never really got a sense of what their brand story was or what they were trying to say in terms of a fashion perspective. There was just a lot of stuff.
A lot of stuff for little money. The main appeal was price.
And if that is your value proposition, you are vulnerable because someone else may figure out how to do it cheaper, and they did.
First came online rivals like Boohoo and ASOS and Fashion Nova. Forever 21 was losing money and shoppers. Some soured on fast fashion and the environmental impact. Others found competitors with fresher styles or higher quality. In 2019, the company declared bankruptcy for the first time. It survived as a shell of itself, bought out in a deal of two big mall operators and a brand licensing company. Then came the pandemic that shuttered stores and the rise of Temu and Shein, shipping clothes from China straight to American shoppers, even cheaper, even faster than Forever 21.
They just got beat.
Retail consultant Portel again.
Yes, they were good, but what makes you good 10 years ago doesn't necessarily make you good today in retail, and that caught up with them.
Forever 21 tried another maneuver by partnering with Shein, giving Shein access to physical stores and Forever 21 a new online audience. That didn't help. One of the new Forever 21 owners later said that buying it was probably his biggest mistake. Today, what's left of the chain is back on the auction block, and it's unclear if anyone wants to buy what it has to offer. Alina Seluch, NPR News.
The Trump administration is gutting the agency that funds Voice of America and other broadcasters who reached audiences in authoritarian countries. This afternoon on All Things Considered, we have the story about Voice of America's legacy in China. Listen on your reliable radio, in the NPR app, or on your smart speaker. Just ask for your local station by name. This is NPR News.
Has the talk of government layoffs, tariffs, and egg prices made you feel stressed, paralyzed? We turn to films that can make sense of the moment. Next time, Here and Now.
The latest in national politics, inspiring podcasts, and a report from your local school board meeting last week. You can hear it all in one place with the NPR app. Download it today.
Good morning, I'm Leila Fadel. Do you want a direct line to Pope Francis? Well, you got one, almost. The Associated Press reports the Vatican's public switchboard is getting more calls lately, with people around the world wanting to know about the Pope's health. Some asked to talk to him themselves. About a dozen sisters of the pious disciples of the Divine Master answer the phones. They say it's important that every caller talks to a real person, even if that person isn't the Pope. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm A. Martinez. The few minutes McKenna Mack Whittam logged in Gotham Football Club's game this past weekend made history. You see, Mack is 14 years old, and so she's the youngest player in the National Women's Soccer League. She's already notched several firsts last year when she signed with the league and when she became the youngest ever player to ink a name, image, and likeness deal. But as a kid in a professional environment, what protections does she have? Let's ask Charlotte Gibson. She's a reporter for ESPN who writes about emerging athletes. So, Charlotte, how did Mack Whittam become a professional at such a young age in the first place?
This year, we did not have a draft, so Mack didn't really have to worry about going through a draft, avoiding a draft, but she did have to sign with Gotham under the guise of the under 18 entry mechanism, which would mean that she basically has to have additional requirements, including provisions around pediatric medical evaluations, facilities and safety assessments, and long-term development plans. And of course, she has to live with a parent or guardian in the NWSL team's market.
Okay, so she does have some protection, separate locker rooms too, right? Someone has to be with her all the time?
Yes, separate locker rooms. And that is a big, big thing right now in NWSL. So you are seeing teams take it into their own hands and make sure that these locker rooms aren't just like these side closets that the players go into and change and get ready for a game. They are mini locker rooms. And I say mini because they're not the full-fledged locker room like the main team gets, but locker rooms that are pretty much adjacent or attached to the main locker room. And in Mack's case, she has great adjacency to her teammates. She's in her separate locker room, but she's close enough that she is not missing out on any team camaraderie right now.
How is it possible, though, to project someone that's 13 in a professional league? I mean, there's so much that comes with physical and mental development, maybe between the ages of 13 and 18, that's impossible to kind of put a finger on.
I think that is the biggest challenge facing the NWSL right now. We have this really big wave of teenage players entering the league, wanting to enter the league, and honestly, they're kind of guinea pigs right now. We don't know how it's going to turn out. NWSL doesn't even know how it's going to turn out. And it is one of those things where you have someone like Mack, who's just this unbelievable, maybe once in a lifetime type of talent, but she is still only 14. She's playing against women who are twice her age and even more than that, right? There are some girls in the NWSL, some women, I will say, who are 38 years old. That is a huge difference when it comes to physicality on the pitch. And so right now we are kind of facing this big challenge with how young is too young? And for someone like Mack, this is all she's known. Soccer is her life. She's lived and breathed soccer since she was a young girl, and she's wanted to play in the NWSL. She wanted to play professionally. Now she's here, and it raises the question, is 14 going to be the cutoff point, or are we going to see someone younger step onto the pitch next season?
Wow, maybe single-digit age range at this point, but we'll see, I guess.
That would be unbelievable, and I imagine that would have to bring in a whole new case of rules and regulations, because I don't even know if the NWSL is fully prepared for this new wave of teenage players entering the league.
That's ESPN's Charlotte Gibson. Charlotte, thanks a lot.
Of course, thank you.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadel.
Today, lessons from a carnival of economics.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Certified Financial Planner Professionals. CFP professionals are committed to acting in their clients' best interest. Learn more about CFP professionals at letsmakeaplan.org.
I'm David Brancaccio. Here's the assignment I got. A business reporter goes to the rodeo. It's part of our series on what we can learn from face-to-face markets in a world where so much commerce has gone remote and digital. What is advertised as the biggest livestock show and rodeo in the world is going on in Texas right now, Rodeo Houston, where lessons on the marketplace play out in many arenas. I say rodeo, you think, you know, yee-haw. And from the other night here at the rodeo.
Look at those long legs fly.
But what I find here is not just a single vibe. Houston rapper of legend, Bun B, celebrating his birthday with 75,000 of his closest friends on the fourth night here. Big face, honey. Again, at this livestock show and rodeo.
People always think of, you know, cowboys, country music, this and that. It blends every crowd that's out here in Houston. You see all sorts of crowd in Houston that come out here to the rodeo.
Fernando Valadares, executive chef and one of the owners of Trill Burgers. Another owner, Bun B himself. This is not Chef Nando's first rodeo. He's an entrepreneur with long experience delivering celebrity-driven dining concepts into the world. Among his tricks of the trade, a focus on taste over marketing.
How we develop the flavors of the burger as a whole, every single layer of it.
To bird dogging, money in and money out.
Everything is ran through numbers, everything is ran through margins.
To logistics, with an expected 2.5 million people walking in over the 3 weeks here at Houston's Energy Complex, Trill Burgers has surged from one to now 7 kitchens at the rodeo. Last year, Valadares had to pull everyone from one of his normal locations to meet demand here. This time, labor supply equals labor demand.
Growing pains, right? Yeah. So this year, we definitely pivoted, and we knew exactly what was needed.
A few hundred yards east, it's a carnival raised to maybe the 11th power. Midway, more like a runway at George Bush International. If I had the courage, I'd get a smoked turkey leg the size of my forearm, but I did get the half a pineapple stuffed with fried shrimp sprinkled with fruity pebbles, all the fault of this guy.
I say throw on your stretchy pants and start on one end of Circle Drive on the Midway and work your way right around the corner.
Dominic Palmieri curates everything to eat at the carnival section here. His tagline is Midway Gourmet, but Carney Economics is also his game.
The people that visit us at the rodeo are struggling and working paycheck to paycheck. So as we're trying to figure out pricing and design and create new menu items, we try and create as much value as possible.
Hence the Texas-sized portions that are doable if you share family style.
While that may be a $16 or $17 item, when you have 4 or 5 people that can share that, that's where you really start to save some money to feed everybody at one time.
Palmieri says when his banker needs a state of the economy check, he doesn't wait for the government data. He calls the carny. For instance, so many of the temps Palmieri hires already have other jobs.
They're looking for work. The biggest section that we have right now is, believe it or not, people that are employed full-time that are coming to us saying, I need an extra 15 to 20 hours a week. I'll work Thursday night, Friday night, Saturday night, Sunday night. Can I come in at 6 and work to close?
On the innovation front, he's just done a U.S. launch of something that's been going over big in Britain.
So it's a beautiful, big, tall, clear plastic cup filled with the most delicious, ripe red strawberries. And then we have this cascading fountain of never-ending, silky, warm chocolate.
The confection came with 2 hard business lessons. Number one, that syrupy, silky chocolate cannot be shipped the cheaper way. Surprise, it needs to be cool but not frozen.
When you talk about a pallet that might have been $300 or $400 or $500 a ship is now $900 to $1,000 a ship.
Lesson 2 is about the never-ending chocolate fountain that's part of the flair. They make the fancy ones in Italy, but those units got stalled at the border this month because U.S. Customs couldn't figure out U.S. trade policy.
Nobody knew. Is there a tariff? Is there not a tariff? We don't know what to do. And it took forever to clear.
Dominic is a pro with a plan B, a less flashy spigot until the Ferrari of fountains made it through.
It's chocolate fountains, right? Little things that
upset the market once in a while that you got to work through, right?
Later this week, also from Houston, the stock market and the livestock market have parallels, plus why a 100X cowboy hat costs more than 10X. All of our tricks of the trade stories are accumulating at Marketplace Online. Plus, there's an opportunity to decide if I look like a poser in my Stetson with our YouTube videos to share at Marketplace APM.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Progressive Insurance. Progressive is currently looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who are interested in building a career and joining an inclusive and unique culture. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. And by Amazon Business, committed to business buying solutions to empower leaders to streamline and focus on growth. Learn more about smart business buying at amazonbusiness.com.
Meeting one of the Federal Reserve's two-day policy session is now underway. With all of the economic uncertainty playing out in markets, how might the Fed's approach, how might they approach their decision that comes tomorrow? Here's economist David Kelly with JP Morgan Funds.
When they put out their new forecast, they're going to up their estimate on inflation this year. They're probably going to cut their estimate for growth. But really, they're like the rest of us. They have to wait and see how government policy evolves on the other side of Washington.
Well, that club of industrialized countries, the OECD, they're not waiting and seeing. They lowered their forecast for global growth for this year.
That's right, and I think they could lower the U.S. some more. I mean, it's too early to say recession, but it does look like the U.S. has slipped a gear here. All the numbers suggest that businesses and consumers and perhaps state and local governments are all hesitating to spend and invest and hire in this environment. And, you know, there is an uncertainty tax, which is one of the biggest taxes levied by Washington, and that tax rate is pretty high right now.
David Kelly, Chief Global Strategist at JP Morgan Funds. Thank you.
Anytime.
The average 30-year fixed-rate mortgage has been hovering around 6.7%, according to Mortgage News Daily's calculation. It was above 7 in mid-February. Stock market's down. The NASDAQ is down nearly 2%. The S&P down 1.2%. The Dow is down 286 points, 0.7%. I'm David Brancaccio from Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Morning Report from APM, American Public Media.
Hiya, fellas. What's new?
Not much.
Not much? Well, hello, Edith. What's new with you?
I've got a new dance. I'd like to show it to you. If you've got rhythm to burn, here's a dance that's easy to learn. If you don't, then your name is Mud. If you don't, you're a social dud, 'cause everybody's learning how to do the Big Apple.
The Big Apple.
And it isn't very hard to do the Big Apple.
The Big Apple.
10 can do it just as well as 2, the Big Apple.
The Big Apple.
Everybody's learning how to do that brand new apple dance. They say an apple a day will keep the doctor away. Hey, hey. It's easy to dance your care.